Yeah, WOIT Madison.
Hi, I'm Mel from The Mel and Floyd Show. Come on down and join Floyd and me Friday, April 5th from 1 to 2 for our annual Wisconsin Film Festival live show. This year we'll be broadcasting from the Bartell Theater, 116 East Mifflin Street. We'll be interviewing our usual assortment of interesting people from the fest, including directors, actors, writers, people from the craft services table, and if we have some time to fill, maybe some interesting-looking passersby. We'll cover raging film controversies such as popcorn, butter or no butter, seating, center or aisle, and how to properly shush a loud patron. Heady stuff? It certainly is. Yes, it's going to be quite the wild ride indeed. So let's all go to the lobby. Come join the fun with Mel and Floyd at the Bartell Theater Friday, April 5th from 1 to 2 for our annual Wisconsin Film Festival remote broadcast.
Hello, I'm Roisin Hasty with the BBC News. International pressure is mounting on Israel to conduct a full and transparent investigation into the strike by its forces that killed 7 aid workers in Gaza. At a NATO summit, the British Foreign Minister David Cameron said an inquiry had to happen very, very quickly. Ilan Nell reports from Jerusalem.
World Central Kitchen has described the team of aid workers it lost as 7 beautiful souls. They were killed in direct strikes on their cars as they left a warehouse in central Gaza where they'd been unloading food aid that had just been brought in by sea. The 3 British nationals who lost their lives were all ex-armed forces working in security. Israel is promising a thorough and transparent inquiry into what happened. Meanwhile, in Gaza, hungry Palestinians are already feeling the impact of the suspension of operations by World Central Kitchen. The charity had been serving 350,000 meals a day in the war-torn territory.
The Constitutional Court in Uganda has rejected a bid to overturn a controversial anti-gay law adopted in May last year, but it did weaken the legislation, saying that parts of it violated constitutional rights. Sections that criminalise behaviour such as allowing gay sex to happen at one's property, failing to report acts of homosexuality and giving someone a terminal illness through gay sex are to be struck. The law imposes life imprisonment for consensual same-sex relations and the death penalty for acts that it describes as aggravated homosexuality. Rescuers in Taiwan are attempting to reach dozens of people trapped in road tunnels after a powerful magnitude 7.4 earthquake. At least 9 people have been killed and more than 900 injured on the island. 60 people are believed to be trapped inside one tunnel on Taiwan's coastal Suwa Highway, including 4 minibuses full of hotel staff. They appear to be unreachable by phone. Taiwan's president-elect William Lai said saving lives was the top priority.
Currently, the most important thing is to rescue people. We need to find out how many people are still trapped and to rescue them as soon as we can. Those injured should be given quality medical treatment so that they can recover quickly.
Zimbabwe has declared a state of disaster over a drought that's left more than 2.5 million people facing hunger. From Harare, here's Shingai Nyoka.
Zimbabwe is now the 3rd Southern African country in just over a month to declare a national emergency. Much like neighbouring Zambia and Malawi, which have also declared disasters, low rainfall wiped out half of the maize crop, the staple food. The grain shortages pushed up food prices. Zimbabwe now joins the regional scramble to find maize on the international market. And the authorities say that the number of people needing food aid will be higher than the...
You wake up to the 8 o'clock buzz to get the week started.
Now, we need the help of a good volunteer to run our on-air operations each Monday.
Sure, that means waking up a little earlier.
To get to the station around 7:30.
But that's why WORT has coffee.
So that you can start your week off right.
WORT is recruiting a volunteer to run the soundboard each week on Monday mornings from 7:30 to 9 a.m.
You'd run all on-air operations for our morning program, The 8 O'Clock Buzz with Brian Standing.
No experience is necessary, but a familiarity with computers and a strong sense of punctuality and reliability are preferred.
For details, call 608-256-256. 2001 and ask to speak with Shali Pittman,
or head online to wortfm.org/volunteer to fill out our volunteer application.
Support for this program comes from Orange Tree Imports, locally owned at 1721 Monroe Street in Madison for almost 50 years. Orange Tree Imports offers a wide array of gifts and kitchenware, including cookware, toys, specialty foods, and Wisconsin products. Information and store hours are available at orangetreeimports.com.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Overture Center for the Arts, presenting the Broadway show The Kite Runner, Friday, May 24th through Sunday, May 26th, in Overture's Capitol Theater. Beginning at a kite-flying tournament in Kabul, The Kite Runner spans two decades and two continents, revealing a journey of forgiveness and shows us all that we can be good again. More information and tickets are available at Overture.com.
Good morning. It is Wednesday, April 3rd, and this is the 8 o'clock buzz. I'm Jan Miyasaki. This morning, I'll be speaking with Michael Omerman, Director of Research for Israel and Palestine at Democracy for the Arab World Now. So Democracy for the Arab World Now, known as DAWN, is a U.S.-based organization that supports democracy and human rights in the Middle East and North Africa. They publish the online journal Democracy in Exile, founded in 2018 by journalist Jamal Khashoggi just months before he was murdered. So I'll be speaking with Michael Omerman about his recent piece where he says the U.S. Departments of Treasury and State should impose sanctions on Israeli banks and others that are violating President Biden's executive order prohibiting funding goods or services to sanctioned Israeli settlers and settlements. So stay tuned to hear from Michael Omerman. Also, I'll be speaking with Josephine Wonson Han. She is a senior research fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice. So Dr. Wonson Han is a social epidemiologist where she focuses on implementing research and racial equity approaches into the study of the criminal justice system. And we'll be talking about the benefits of taking an inclusive approach to criminal justice research and policy making. So we'll be talking about why inclusive criminal justice research matters. And then later I'll be speaking with Tara C. Smith. She's a professor at the Kent State University College of Public Health. So Dr. Smith leads the Emerging Infections Laboratory there. And we'll be talking about the status of the anti-vaccine movement. In some states, we're seeing vaccine mandates start to fall. And she says for the anti-vaccine groups that she follows, there's a meta-narrative around infectious diseases no longer being considered dangerous. So stay tuned to hear from Dr. Tara C. Smith. And we'll take a short break and we'll be right back. And it's 8:10, and joining me is Michael Omerman, Director of Research for Israel and Palestine at Democracy for the Arab World Now, a U.S.-based organization that supports democracy and human rights in the Middle East and North Africa. And, you know, if you aren't familiar with it, you know, look at their website. They publish the online journal Democracy in Exile. And so Michael Omerman is an expert on politics and society in the region, where he focuses on Israel's policies of occupation and annexation, its civil and human rights record, and the influence of the U.S.-Israeli Israel relationship over those areas. And I wanted to talk with him about a recent piece that I read where he says the U.S. Departments of Treasury and state should impose sanctions on Israeli banks and others that are violating President Biden's executive order. The order is 14115, prohibiting funding, goods, or services to sanctioned Israeli settlers and settlements. So thank you. Good morning, Michael Omerman, for joining me.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Hey, you know, I can't say, you know, more, you know, any, I just want to say more about the group, Dawn, and to have people, you know, log on to your website. The site, the group founded in 2018 by journalist Jamal Khashoggi, just months before he was murdered. But Michael, can you talk about what the Executive Order 14115 calls for?
Sure. So it's actually incredibly broad. In that it allows the State Department and Treasury Department and effectively the White House to put U.S. financial sanctions on anybody who is harming prospects for a two-state solution, but specifically those using violence against civilians to do so. But it's broad enough that it the language includes Israeli officials, people who are supporting those efforts and using threats of violence to drive Palestinians off land. And, you know, unfortunately, that is describing the act of settlement, which is, you know, using violence and the threat of violence to take over land and drive another people off of it. So it's, you know, its potential is only limited by the political will to use it.
Right. So talk about if it's being enforced in any meaningful way.
Well, they're using it in a very, I hesitate to use the word escalatory because I don't think we've reached an escalation yet. But they're titrating up the level of people and entities that they're sanctioning. So in the beginning, it was a few individual violent settlers, which, you know, in the discourse of Israel-Palestine and the occupation and settlements, they're usually referred to as bad apples, as exceptions to the rule. But you know, we know that these are the people who are the ones actively driving Palestinians off their land, which is the point of this executive order. And then in the next level, in the next round of sanctions, they included a few settlements themselves, which is setting a pretty big precedent. Because these settlement outposts that they used were specifically ones that are not legal under Israeli law and are being used to expand the footprint of settlements. So it's they've started out on this lower level. They've started to escalate a little bit. We've heard rumors that they are going after higher profile figures, that they're interested in organizations and institutions and even government officials, sort of local government officials that are directly involved in these types of violent activities. But, you know, it could go much higher than that and effectively cut off the entire settlement enterprise, which is, you know, hundreds and thousands of people and millions of dollars of business and normal everyday transactions. It could force Israel to choose between maintaining a normal economy connected to the rest of the world and maintaining its settlement project.
So your piece talks about the number, and you identify some of these, the number of Israeli banks, financial institutions, and private companies that are facilitating this violation of the executive order, and you have been documenting that. Can you tell us about what you found?
Sure. So we actually did something very similar in the first round of sanctions when we saw that immediately after the imposition of the sanctions, one of the sanctioned individuals started a crowdfunding campaign effectively to bypass them, to replace the money that had been frozen by an Israeli bank. And we looked at, you know, who was allowing that to take place. We found that this crowdfunding website called GiveCheck, it's an Israeli company, but with ties to the United States economy, was running the crowdfunding campaign, that a credit card processor that has lots of international clients was processing transactions, and that even one of Israel's largest banks, Bank Hapoalim, was allowing its app processor, kind of like Venmo, to take donations also for this campaign. We, you know, communicated all of that to the Treasury and State and the enforcement units, and the campaign was frozen. And then in the second round of sanctions on March 14th, we saw the same thing happen with another one of the sanctioned individuals and entities, and the same bank was facilitating this. And so we sent a similar investigation to the U.S. authorities. The campaign is still up, but the major Israeli bank has pulled their processor from it. And it's, you know, it's a little bit of a cat and mouse game, but at the same time, the point of these sanctions is not to punish somebody, but it's to make these systems more difficult to operate. It's to put pressure on the Israeli government and all the people who are really behind this type of activity, and not just the ones carrying it out.
That's it. That's right. The say more about you know, so you have the crowdfunding, you have the credit card processors, the banks. How much money have you been able to follow so far?
Each of these campaigns is raising around between about $300,000 to $1 million. You know, it's not the entire sustenance of these types of settlements or these settlers, but it is certainly significant money that allows them to continue their activities, at least until they can figure out what to do about the sanctions. You know, the Israeli finance minister has come out and said that he's going to do everything in his power to fight these sanctions on their behalf. So we'll see what that results in.
And your director, the executive director of DAWN, says ultimately the Biden administration will be forced to recognize that the Israeli government itself is aiding and abetting lawless settlers and settlements terrorizing Palestinians. So, you know, you have the folks that are out there on the lines, but it goes all the way up to the system, through the systems, as you said.
Well, I don't think that's even a question. I think the question is rather, you know, what is the United States prepared to do about it? Because we've tolerated that situation for decades. And obviously something has changed now. And part of it has to do with who is in the Israeli government right now. Part of it has to do with both the domestic and international political context of the United States' support for the war in Gaza and the consequences that that's having, and the need to show that they're doing something else on a different front. But, you know, the Israeli settlements are 100% an Israeli state project, national project. So it's not about whether it goes to the top or not. It's about what type of pressure they're willing to put on the Israeli government in order to get them to stop it.
And you're doing this cat and mouse. You're catching folks. It's clearly not good enough, as you're saying. It's much bigger than that. So you continuously are presenting your results to State and Treasury, and what happens?
You know, there's not a lot of transparency in this type of sanctions. It's, you know, these are, and maybe it's a good time to mention that, you know, these are not the type of sanctions that the United States uses against allies and partners usually. When this first came out, I was caught off guard. I didn't think that the United States was going to do that. because, you know, I looked and saw that of all the countries the United States has bilateral trade agreements with, free trade agreements with, there's only one other that has this type of sanctions on it. And usually it's countries like Iran, like Cuba, like North Korea, and you know, drug kingpins that have this type of sanctions against them. So it's, you know, it's one tool. It's laying out a gigantic economic weapon. They have not indicated that they're ready to use its full force, or that they may ever be willing to. I kind of relate it to, you know, positioning an aircraft carrier to send a message. But just because you put it there doesn't mean you're necessarily going to fire all of the cruise missiles on board. So it's really a political question, you know, what they're going to do with it, and at what, you know, to what end?
And, you know, because, and money, can they fine these institutions big?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, a letter from the director of enforcement at Treasury, at OFAC, the Office of Foreign Asset Control, to any bank in the world is going to get a lot of attention. And their risk compliance officers, officers and compliance officers are going to be pushing very hard for them to comply with these kind of things, because the potential consequences are so great. So it doesn't always take sanctioning of new individuals to enforce the policy behind the sanctions. Sometimes the threat is enough, but we really have to see, because the Israeli government is not, you know, there's a reason that they're using the sanctions that they usually use on adversaries. And that's because the Israeli government on this particular issue, and I would argue on others as well, is pretty belligerent toward U.S. policy and declared interests. And it just hasn't risen to the level of requiring such a powerful response until now, at least as far as the administration is concerned.
And I don't know if it's the mainstream media in Israel are sort of, you write, displaying open defiance. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. You know, I mean, the example that I wrote about, it was almost predictable in a way. It was a right-wing media outlet that's closely associated with the settlement and the movement. But, you know, you don't have to go to the media. You can, you know, the Israeli finance minister on April 1st said, you know, we're going to fight this with all of our might. And not only that, but he described the people who were sanctioned as people who are guarding the lands of our country. If that's not an endorsement of their actions, you know, it really doesn't get much clearer. And I think that's why we're seeing these sanctions today, is because that open brazenness, that open defiance is coming from the very top levels, and certainly permeating through much of Israeli society and culture and thought leaders. But that's always been the case. The settlement enterprise has never been something that they've had to look at as something which could threaten the relationship with the United States. And that's the point of the sanctions, is to say that, yes, it will.
So this executive order calling for these sanctions is reserved for kind of a small group of nations that the U.S. has these similar sanctions against. So that's a big deal. But what to those who are listening, you know, they're hearing you doing these investigations, this cat and mouse, you know, thing going on. What can listeners do? What kind of action?
You know, it's these type of sanctions are not really participatory, and even when we send our investigations, you know, you have to just believe that that the right person is gonna receive it and do the right thing with it. So there's nothing directly to do there. I think, you know, the best thing is to inform yourself and make your own sort of personal consumer decisions according to what you believe is right and worthy of your support, and to withhold it from that which is not.
When you have identified these companies that are facilitating the transfer of these funds, are there any that are U.S.-based?
You know, there are lots of foundations that funnel nonprofit donations to Israeli settlement enterprise. There's an organization with a very helpful website called Who Profits that people can look up that I think makes more of the connection to brands and products that the U.S. consumers might encounter more frequently. But of the ones that we found in these campaigns specifically, they're fairly niche organizations, and the banks are Israeli banks, so the most American consumers wouldn't encounter them.
That's really helpful. Thank you. So this is one piece of your research. Are you also keeping track on any kind of other law enforcement activities against settlers?
Well, you know, perhaps what I'll just say is that, you know, I was a journalist in Israel-Palestine for close to two decades. I've been following, you know, and working with human rights organizations that do these types of investigation and tracking for a long time. There's nothing new here. The reason this is happening is not because the United States government is insistent on punishing these six individuals or two farms. It's happening because the Israeli government, the Israeli police, and the Israeli army not only choose to not enforce the law against violent settlers, against who enact violence against Palestinians and take over their land and steal their land. They enable it. They actively enable it by providing security. Sometimes, you know, they go in together. Recently, we've seen settlers going in army uniforms so that it's almost impossible to distinguish between the two. And one of the first people who was sanctioned, the one we did our first investigation on, his wife was interviewed, I believe, by ABC News. And she said, you know, it's not us. You know, if you have a problem, like whenever we have a problem with the Arabs, we just call the army and they do the work for us. Like it's very clear. It's been clear.
Yes.
that this is an issue that the Israeli state is directly involved in, and that its lack of law enforcement is really just a symptom of the fact that they're supporting something that is a state project. You know, most of the settlements in the West Bank are legal under Israeli law and get services from the same utility companies and internet providers and, you know, road and water infrastructure as Israelis in Tel Aviv and Haifa and Jerusalem. This is not a fringe thing. They're targeting the fringes because it's easier. But the point, I think, is that this is not a few bad apples. And I really do hope that we see the sanctions start to reflect that in the future.
And these sanctions going into effect in February, just this last 2 months or a month and a half, correct?
Yes, they had imposed some travel sanctions a little bit before that, but it happened on February 1st, and that was the first time.
Yeah. Yes. Well, you know, I appreciate that whole larger context because, of course, that's so important to keep centered. I'm speaking with Michael Omerman, Director of Research for Israel-Palestine at Democracy for the Arab World Now, a U.S.-based organization that supports democracy and human rights in the Middle East and North Africa, and they publish the online journal Democracy in Exile, Dawn, founded in 2018 by journalist Jamal Khashoggi, just months before he was murdered. I would log on to the website, look for Michael Omerman's byline and follow it. Thank you, Michael Omerman, for joining me this morning.
Thank you so much. Good morning to everybody listening.
It's just about 8:30. We'll take a break and then we'll come back with Josephine Wan Sun Han. So stay with us. Come. 31, and thank you, Dave, our music producer and engineer. That's 10,000 Maniacs. I have to say, it's really what I needed today, and I'm enjoying it. Just want to circle back. Michael Omerman, that is Omer-Man, and that is Michael Omer-Man. Joining me is Josephine Wanson-Hahn, Senior Research Fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice. Dr. Wanson-Hahn is a social epidemiologist where she focuses on implementing research and racial equity approaches in the study of the criminal justice system. And I wanted to talk with her about her recent piece at the Brennan Center for Justice on the benefits of taking an inclusive approach to criminal justice research. And then policymaking and why this inclusive criminal justice research matters. So good morning, Josephine Wanson-Hahn. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you so much, Jen, for having me.
So it's great to have you on. I wanted to talk about just this approach first and then this demonstration that you saw of its effectiveness on New York City's misdemeanor enforcement system. But talk about the inclusive approach to criminal justice research and then policymaking.
Sure. So at the Brennan Center for Justice, we are really proud to present new research on the misdemeanor enforcement system. We were able to obtain 7 years of non-public court data, and we focused on how the misdemeanor system is really shrinking over our study period in ongoing trends. But we found that racial disparities truly persist. Both in the cases that we were seeing, criminal cases, as well as in the neighborhoods that are enforced. So something we thought was really important to do was to conduct incredibly in-depth qualitative research. We engaged with 166 stakeholders. These range from law enforcement, police and prosecutors, business leaders, government officials, nonprofit providers, community advocates, and especially Black and Latino community leaders, from the neighborhoods that are most impacted by misdemeanor arrests and enforcement. We think that it's incredibly important because people impacted most by the criminal justice system are collaborators, and we should integrate their expertise throughout the research process. It really strengthened our data findings. It helped us understand what was behind the numbers, what were the experience behind the arrests and the court cases, and what was promising.
And, you know, this approach is used in public health fields, mm-hmm. education, access to voting, that sort of thing. But not so much in criminal justice, but getting better. What's been the resistance?
You know, I think that it's just that we have a lot of barriers in criminal justice, both in making sure that we're building trust in relationships with communities most impacted, of course. And actually, there's always been an interest in ensuring that we understand what's driving, what's underneath the underlying problems that are driving criminal justice enforcement. So recent studies around gun use culture, prosecutorial reforms in prisons have occurred, but we really think that more of these inclusive approaches need to be uptaken in research and policy.
And so even you're using this now to look at guns and other kinds of violence or crimes, right? That we were, is it fair to say, kind of avoiding to look at it through a public health lens?
No. It's to integrate these perspectives. You know, of course, in criminal justice, in order to move forward, we need to understand, you know, the perspectives from stakeholders in the system, like law enforcement and government officials, as well as the ones doing work on the ground, nonprofits, as well as community leaders who are working hard to build safety. So, you know, we know that those closest to the problems are closest to the solutions, and we want to make sure that we're tapping that wisdom and expertise.
Okay, I got it. Now, what do you mean by the social determinants of justice?
Right. So I've been told to avoid jargon, but really simply, what we mean is it's a public health term. And what we mean is, as an example of our inclusive research, we found a lot of similar themes across our stakeholders that really are referred to in public health and in criminal justice research as the social determinants of justice. That means that ongoing disinvestments and racial segregation are really what perpetuate concentrated enforcement in low-income communities, particularly in Black and Latino communities. These lead to structural disadvantages that are common, higher poverty, higher unemployment, more housing instability, addiction challenges, and lack of access to health. All of this was exacerbated over the pandemic. And we also found that from stakeholders, as well as a growing evidence base, that there was agreement from law enforcement to the communities that punitive-only approaches are ineffective if they do not address what's underlying the justice involvement, such as addiction, mental health, and homelessness. People will then cycle in and out of the system. We've seen this for years.
You know, that exact phrase I had never really used until I was looking at your work, this social determinants of justice, which I will always now use. I think that isn't jargony. I think people, that really summarizes exactly what, your work is about. But when you were bringing people together, I just wanted to talk about another of the research strategies on this practice is bringing people across the sectors together to do what?
Well, we had to fit into a lot of people's busy schedules. So we would conduct meetings. We would do interviews. We do focus groups, with consent with different stakeholders based on their availability and interest. So we were basically reaching out to a wide range of, from law enforcement to business community, government and community leaders to see who was interested in talking to us about understanding misdemeanor enforcement and particularly what was driving these racial disparities and what could be done. So we got a lot of interest. They were separate meetings and interviews and focus groups, but we also, at Brennan, we do like to convene stakeholders across the board.
And yes, I've got a sense of what you mean. And, sometimes when I've been in meetings that are attempting to do that, it's hard to get people engaged, whether you have community people and you might have others at the table, how were you able to keep people engaged?
That's a great question, Jen. The biggest thing for us was to bring people our research questions as well as our initial data at every stage and use it as a talking piece. We were showing people our data trends and findings at all throughout the study. And then we'd ask, tell us what this looks like in your work. What does this look like in your lived experience? And tell us what it means, behind the numbers. What are the experiences in your communities? What's the experience in your work life? Tell us about the trends and what's really been driving them. And we got a lot. People were very engaged, because I think we came with a level setting. We came with a lot of concrete asks, and we came with our own work as well as the invitation to really weigh in.
And were you folks meeting in person or virtually?
It was a combination. We're still in the aftermath of the height of the pandemic, but especially for our community engagements, we would go in person to the South Bronx and East Harlem, and we were graciously hosted by certain community-based organizations.
I need to mention the third core inclusive research strategy, and that is that people were compensated for their time and expertise, right? That needs to be mentioned.
Absolutely. It's so important. As a standard in social sciences research, we are compensating, a range of experts, typically academic experts or system experts, and we believe that impacted experts are no different. So we absolutely compensated people for their time and expertise. We also made considerations about accommodations for participation, travel, childcare, food, availability, and then we also compensated those community organizations that I was talking about who helped us with recruitment and provided physical space.
And so now, talk about the impact of this kind of data on policymaking and the New York findings.
Absolutely. So as I said, we were really able to understand the context behind our quantitative numbers. And we heard these really important resulting themes that, scoped out of just the criminal justice system, but helps us understand these structural factors like housing instability, poorer health, and lack of economic opportunity, frankly. Participants also did recommend how to tackle some of these factors. So we believe that these types of participatory inclusive approaches lead to contextualization as well as actionable findings.
So tell us about the misdemeanor enforcement then in New York that you looked at and how there were fewer misdemeanor cases, but still the racial disparity. So now you had documentation of that, right?
That's right. So over our study period between 2016 and 2022, misdemeanors made up about 75% of all criminal cases filed. And New York City really saw significant declines. Over 50% of declines in cases from over 200,000 cases in 2016 to just about 100,000 in 2020. But racial disparities persisted. They were pretty stable over every year of the study period. Black and Latino New Yorkers were particularly overrepresented in these misdemeanor cases compared to their resident population. Blacks are six times more likely and Latinos three times more likely to have these cases compared to white folks citywide.
And then when you intersect that with the social determinants of justice, it tells us what to do, right? And yet we don't always do it.
That's exactly right. That's why it's so important for us to take this type of mixed methods and inclusive approach to engage the stakeholders, the wide range of stakeholders who really understand enforcement as well as their impacts. So we were able to scope out and understand the larger structural factors that drive this concentrated enforcement. I cannot stress that enough. We also continue to go back to our community experts to check on the findings, the themes, to make sure that what we were saying was accurate, and to make sure that we were really reflecting their experiences. And again, we've actually heard so much common ground agreement across the themes from law enforcement to communities at this time.
And you know, I think that folks, you know, are familiar with what we've been talking about. They're aware of this kind of movement to promote this kind of research. But we just continue to need more of it to make a policymaking point, don't you think?
I think that's exactly right, Jen. And I really appreciate the ability to spotlight inclusive research practices here today.
And that is, how is that spoken about in your world as a social epidemiologist through law enforcement groups? Is there much resistance?
I think there's a lot of recognition from funders to system actors, including law enforcement, in particular prosecutor offices, for example. There is actually a growing attention that we are missing a wide range of experiences and wisdom tapping people and communities that are going through the systems themselves. So I think that we have actually heard a lot more acceptance of these practices. So we're hopeful.
I am speaking with Josephine Wansun Han. She's Senior Research Fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice. You know, I did want to ask you, since I have a minute, exactly what we mean by the term social epidemiologist.
Social epidemiologist is a public health term. What epidemiologist just means that we look at different health issues at a population level, meaning that we look at it, you know, from large groups. And then social epidemiology just means that we look at different social issues like poverty, criminal justice system, et cetera.
Thank you. Josephine Wansun Han is a senior research fellow at the Brennan Center for Justice. Dr. Han is a social epidemiologist. And we're talking about a piece that she has at the Brennan Center for Justice, a website on why inclusive criminal justice research matters. I know a lot of people think about this in our community, and just another bit more of the data to support all of this. So thank you, Dr. Han, for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me, Jen.
Yeah, take care. It's just about 8:45. We're going to take a short break, and then joining me will be Dr. Tara C. Scott, Smith. So stay with us.
Give me city. The kid's my favorite. I've seen him, seen him. I see him every day. Seen him run outside looking for a place to hide from his father. The kid half naked and said to myself,
it's just about 8:47, and I'm enjoying the music, Dave. I can't dance, but I am dancing in the studio during these music breaks. Joining me is Dr. Tara C. Smith. She's a professor at the Kent State University College of Public Health. She leads the Emerging Infections Laboratory there, and I wanted to talk with her about the status of the anti-vaccine movement. In fact, in some states, we're seeing vaccine mandates start to fall. And she says that for the anti-vaccine groups she follows, there's a meta-narrative around infectious disease no longer being considered dangerous. I just wanted to read an additional quote here from Dr. Smith. Although infectious disease outbreaks have been covered relatively well by the media, the public is missing stories about people who have been harmed by these diseases. 20% of kids with measles are hospitalized. They're getting glossed over in exchange for the controversy about vaccination. And I have absolutely, I have to agree with you, Dr. Smith. I've seen that right in front of my eyes on the media, on TV. Good morning, Dr. Tara C. Smith, for joining me. Thank you for joining me.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Hey, so I guess I wanted to start with, you follow anti-vaccine groups, correct? Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, I have long been interested in science denial and why people don't accept, you know, what those of us in scientific fields would view as, you know, factual information. So I've been doing this for almost 30 years now. So I need to keep up with kind of what the current rumors are, what is being spread in these groups, so that we know good ways to at least, you know, to counter it or to talk to people about the rumors that are showing up. So I follow a number of groups on various different social media platforms to see what they're talking about and what the current fears are and the current rumors that are being spread amongst these groups.
And, you know, I get why some highly marginalized folks are really, you know, suspicious and careful and but that's not who we're talking about exactly, right? We're talking about this other kind of anti-vaccine group that has this meta-narrative around infectious disease no longer being dangerous, right? So there are those kind of groups. Do you see them as different?
Yeah, I mean, it's always a mix, right? Some of the groups that I follow are some of the like state groups that have been splintered off from Children's Health Defense. So Children's Health Defense is the group led by Robert F. Kennedy Jr. You know, I would definitely consider that an anti-vaccine group. There was a report a couple years ago that suggested it was one of the leading 12 groups out there spreading misinformation on social media about vaccines. So those are some that I follow. Those are usually run by people who are affiliated with Children's Health Defense in some manner, even as, you know, just volunteers for that group. And they are some of the worst ones and spread some of the, you know, the worst information. And that's usually a top-down group where the only posts that come into those groups are from the people who run them. And then I follow, you know, the comments and discussion amongst those. But there are also groups of you know, that are more run from the bottom up, from individuals that, you know, are scared of vaccines, from individuals that themselves or their children may have had what they believe is a bad vaccine reaction, and, you know, they aren't sure what to do. So those are more groups where there's a whole spectrum of individuals, you know, some who are convinced that vaccines are the worst thing we've ever developed, and some who are, you know, maybe new parents who really haven't looked into vaccines and are just trying to figure out, you know, what is going on. And this was a group that might have been suggested to them by the social media algorithm, and they joined just to see kind of what is happening and trying to figure out what is true and what to believe. So it really is a spectrum from those who are very convinced and very active in spreading these anti-vaccine rumors to those who just really don't know what to believe and are trying to figure it all out.
And then is this do the bottom-up anti-vaccine groups and the top-down anti-vaccine groups coalesce at some point in the middle?
Good question. I mean, I think you see a lot of people who get information from those top-down groups end up in the bottom-up groups. And, you know, they're the ones who really kind of drive some of this fear in some of those. So I don't know that there's necessarily a coalescence in the middle, but there certainly is a lot of back and forth between the two types of groups.
You mentioned the top-down ones. I don't know if you said you thought they were more dangerous. I don't want to misquote you. Say more about the top-down groups.
Yeah, so I would characterize them as probably more dangerous, because that's where a lot of these rumors infiltrate other groups. They come from these groups because, again, they're affiliated often with others that are responsible for a lot of the misinformation on social media. And so, you know, they spread news stories or things like that that come from some of the top misinformation creators like Kennedy and others. And then they're really the ones from where these stories trickle down into other sites. Once a story is removed from some of those sites, you know, people might not know that this rumor came from Children's Health Defense or RFK Jr. or what have you. In the bottom up groups, you know, they just hear about this story and you know, this thing that's scary about vaccines, and they don't understand that it might be spread by some of these really virulent anti-vaccine groups. So I think that's where a lot of, you know, the top-down ones are where a lot of this stuff originates on social media and then is spread into some of those others.
Is the research that these top-down groups spread out there, is it marginal research or just completely misinformation? Or marginal research could be the same thing as misinformation. How would you characterize the science?
Yeah, I mean, so there is a... In scientific publishing, there is a wide variety of quality of journals, right? I try to publish when I publish my research. You know, I look at journals that I know are of high quality and can, you know, and are respected in the field. Unfortunately, there are journals that are really out there just to make money, because sometimes they charge fees to authors to publish in some of these, and they have very low standards to get publications into some of these journals. We call them predatory journals. And so sometimes really bad scientific papers can be published, especially in some of these predatory journals, and then that gives them like a stamp of approval, right? That it has been published in, you know, a peer-reviewed journal, even if it's a really poor journal. And then those get spread by, again, some of these anti-vaccine activists and, you know, individuals who aren't familiar with scientific publishing or don't know how to look up the original paper themselves or don't know how to evaluate the research, which is, I mean, I think most people, right? Most people don't spend their lives staring at scientific journals like I do. And they just don't know that, you know, these journals are terrible, or in some cases even the studies have been retracted, which means that the editors of the journal have decided, well, we don't have any confidence in the study anymore, and we're basically going to say it's unpublished. Some of those studies that have been retracted still get spread in these anti-vaccine groups. So there's a lot of kind of taking advantage of people's, you know, lack of understanding of this process, and, you know, lack of access to these journals in some cases, because a lot of them are behind paywalls. And so you just have to kind of accept what you are told. And that leads to a lot of spread of bad information in some of these groups.
No, I'm thinking, I'm just listening so closely. The debate, the anti-vaccine controversy, I see this. I'll be watching the news, and I could see here's this small story about an infectious disease outbreak, but then a much bigger story on some kind of anti-vaxxer that kind of prevails. That concerns you, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, in the media, I think there's always been this idea of balance, right? You don't want to misrepresent something or, you know, not tell two sides of a story. But the thing is with science, you know, and with vaccines or lots of other things that are, quote unquote, controversial, there really isn't a lot of controversy scientifically. It's the social and political and these other aspects that are controversial. And so they'll have a story about, you know, a new vaccine that is being produced or used or whatever. And you'll have, you know, one person who took the vaccine or maybe participated in a clinical trial or something, and another person who says, you know, that the vaccine harmed them or something like that. And, you know, there can be harms from vaccines, but they're very rare. I mean, or otherwise these vaccines would not be approved for general use. So, you know, even though you have a, you know, somebody who may have had a vaccine side effect that is one in a million, that's given the same weight and the same time to tell their story as, you know, the people who had absolutely no contraindications, no issues with the vaccine, which is, you know, a million times greater. So we've tried to educate, you know, journalists and the media about this idea of false balance. And, you know, we know you don't have to give equal time to somebody who is denying the effectiveness of vaccines when you have a story about, you know, a new vaccine that is created or something like that.
The you say that there's a meta-narrative amongst those anti-vaccine groups that you follow into a denial, you say, of germ theory, that infectious disease no longer is no longer being considered dangerous. Is that your take on it, or is that what they're really saying?
Yeah, no, that's what they're really saying. It's kind of scary. I feel like we've gone back 200 years in some of these groups that, you know, that some of them, the more extreme end, deny that germs exist, period, that there's no such thing as a virus that has never been, you know, seen or isolated, which, of course, is absurd. I mean, we've known, for example, with COVID, you know, we isolated it. We had the entire genome of that within a few days of its finding in early 2020. So we know these things. We can compare their genetic sequences for, you know, current H5N1 cases, influenza that we're seeing in cows and things like that. You know, we know every nucleotide of their existence. But these people suggest that those don't exist, or that, okay, maybe they exist, but they're harmless. That, you know, if you're healthy, you will never be harmed by any kind of germ, which I would love it if that were true, but that's just not the case. You know, that healthy people get sick from these infections and sometimes get seriously ill and even die from them, you know, more frequently than we would like. So it's kind of concerning that we're bringing back these, you know, 200-year-old ideas about infectious diseases, and that these ideas that, you know, you shouldn't vaccinate your child because a natural infection is better for them, when we know that's just not the case. And some children will be seriously harmed if they're left vulnerable to these, and some will die. So that's what we're really concerned about.
I want folks to know that I'm talking with Dr. Tara C. Smith. She's a professor in the College of Public Health at Kent State University. And you can, I found her through the Institute for Public Accuracy, which is the organization founded by Norman Solomon, who is with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. And if you just want to log on to learn more about her and her research and her work, just log on to the Kent State University College of Public Health website. Great to talk with you. Thank you so much to talk with you this morning. Thanks to Dave Lawrenson, our music producer and engineer. I'm Jan Miyasaki, and I'll talk with you next week.
And it's 9 o'clock. You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM. Madison. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Insurgent Radio Kiosk, and then we're going to go back to the country.
This is the Insurgent Radio Kiosk for Wednesday, April 3rd.
This is Bird Note. Most warblers don't make appearances at bird feeders, but pine warblers often do. They're unique among warblers in their fondness for seeds. You can find them year-round in pine forests of the Southeast U.S., the Bahamas, Haiti, and the Dominican Republic. And if you know where to look this spring, you have a good chance of seeing them migrate through cities in the Midwest and East Coast. If there's a pine or two in a nearby park or backyard, look for a small, agile bird picking through needles for caterpillars, insects, and seeds. And listen for its song, a sweet-sounding trill of about 2 seconds. Pine warblers have a yellowish neck, with the yellow reaching down to the belly on the males. Their backs are olive green, their wings black, with white wing bars. True to their name, pine warblers spend most of their lives in pine trees, where they find their food and make their nests out of twigs, needles, and spider webs. This quirky